Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to all. My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic. Our faith tradition states that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Valley Group honors this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery speakers in the Western Hemisphere so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, we recognize one of these speakers for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group's Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of September 19, 2005. Asked her what service position she has held, and she was a supply person for 2 years, a secretary for 3 years. She's an alternate secretary coordinator for her home meeting. She's been involved in H&I and as well as a sponsor. I also asked her what her AA motto, her favorite AA motto is, and she said one day at a time. So, without any further ado, may I have the envelope, please? Woo! The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week Award is... I wanted to get it right. Elena S. from Fresno.
Thank you. My name is Elena. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful for another day sober today and give all the credit to my higher power. I take no credit for my sobriety today. My sobriety date is September 1905. I'm nervous, but you know what? It's okay to get nervous. And I'm from Fresno, California. My home group is LOLT, Life on Life's Terms, you know. And to tell you a little bit about my story, to share my experience, strength, and hope with you, I'm not used to this microphone. I mean, I can talk loud if I want to talk loud, but I ain't trying to go there right now. You know, I'm nervous. To tell you a little bit about my experience, strength, and hope, you know what, I come from a very, very dysfunctional family, you know, and, you know, I came from a family, there was 11 of us kids. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was not an alcoholic, nor was she an addict. My mother had a mental illness, you know, today, which was what I would say schizo. And I came from a very, very violent background. There was always fighting in my house, you know, as far back as I can remember. There was always fighting. You know, I come from a traditional Mexican family where they fight with the machetes, whatnot. You know, it was a very, very violent home life that I come from. And along with that, you know, violent, you know, a lot of things happened to me growing up. You know, and this is AA, but you know, a lot of things happened to me growing up as a child. You know, I was abused in every way, you know, that you can think of, you know. So I learned at a young age to disassociate with reality. And what happened with me, that's how I learned to cope with life, you see. That's how I dealt with life the best way I could. And then at the age of 12, I'm getting hot, hold on. And then at the age of 12, I got introduced. I don't know how many of you are as old as me, but my first drink was Olympia. I used to drink Olympia. That was my first beer, you know, I drank. And you know, when I drank that beer, it tasted nasty, but it had a warm feeling to my stomach. You know, it made me feel good. And there's where my life took off with alcohol. You see, from there, I graduated to Thunderbird. You see, I wasn't your, you know, fancy drinker. I was a ghetto drinker. I drank whatever was there, you see, because I didn't. And what it did for me was I learned not to feel. You see, I found something that took me from that disassociation. You know, I learned to numb out at an early age. And from that age, I always drank, you know, and there's different parts of my life that I don't remember, but I do remember that I always drank, you know, and it's kind of sad because with the drinking came, you know, at a very young age, I was a runaway. I used to run away from home, you know, and I was always locked up. You know, I spent a lot of my youth locked up, and as crazy as it seems, you know what, I felt safe when I was locked up. when I was locked up, and it was really sad to work in my steps, my inventory. Today I've learned that, you know, God was not healthy, but to me it was safe from what was happening to me out here in the world. You see, and my life from there transpired. You know what, I just learned to drink. And along with the drinking came substances, you know. And it went on and on. You know, I was always drinking, you know. You know, I never knew what it was not to drink. What it was not to abuse drugs. And it just came. You know, I became a teenager and I always drank. I always did drinking and among other things too. You know, and number of substance abuse. Because the bottom line, what I'm getting to is I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to feel. That's where I'm trying to get to. Is I never wanted to feel. You know, I never wanted, you know, what the big book talks about, that loneliness deep in the heart of every alcoholic. You know, I mentioned them out at a real, real young age. And my life continued, you know, and at the age of 18, well, at the age of 15, let me back up a little bit. At the age of 15, I got in a relationship, you know, because to get away from home, I got together with my first three, I have four daughters, and three of them are from one man, and I got together with that man, and you know, because I was looking for love in all the wrong places, and I thought that he was going to cure me, you know, I thought he was going to help me. And when I got into this relationship with this man at this young age, it was a domestic violence. You know, he always hit me, he always abused me, and I drank. I drank to numb out the pain. You see, I drank, and that's all I did was drink to numb out that pain. And then I had a baby at the age of 18. I had my first daughter, and she's real dear to my heart, and I'll talk about her later in my story. And this little girl, you know, she's 34 years old today, and she just had a birthday 4 days ago. And when I had this little girl, and I held her, I can remember, I believe that was my first touch to a feeling, you know, a feeling to love, to want to be loved, or to love something that was mine to love, you know. And I had this little girl, and I stopped everything. I quit the drinking and everything for a little while. And when I say a little while, I'm talking maybe about a year or 2 years. And then I had another little baby. And through all this, I'm in this relationship, and I'm getting hit, I'm getting abused, I'm getting my ass whipped, whatnot, you see. And then I go back to the drinking, and I go back to the other stuff. And then I have this third baby. And when I had this third child, I gave up on me. I gave up on me, I gave up on my kids, but I held on to my kids. I still have my kids, so when I say I gave up, I was no longer that mother no more. See, I put the drugs and I put the alcohol before all them. And there's when my life zoomed off, you see. And I didn't know how to be a mother. So my life from there, I was about 21, 22 at that age, at that time. And I became alive. I did what I had to do to survive in that lifestyle that I was living. You see, and I had no feelings toward my kids. You see, that moment when I had my first daughter, you know, when I held her, when I loved her, that feeling left me by the third kid. And I became more of a drinker. From there, I graduated to vodka. You know, I got a little bit better. I put the Thunderbird down. I picked up vodka. But along with that vodka, I also picked up a drug, you know, and there's no disrespect to AA, but this is my story. I was a heroin addict for 21 years of my life, you see. And all along that time that I did that drug, I also did the vodka. I never put that alcohol down. And it's kind of funny because I always thought that I was better. I was always in denial. I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just an addict because I couldn't stand the thought of where I came from, my father being an alcoholic, seeing what alcohol did. But little did I know that I was an alcoholic too. And I learned that through the steps. And when I did that lifestyle, it took me to prison. It took me to the streets. It took me to a lot of stuff I'm not proud of. And all along, I dragged my kids with me. You see, CPS never got involved in my life. I wish they would have, you know, because that disease took me to places I'm not proud of and had me to do things I'm not proud of. And I try. I got introduced to this program back in 1989, but I wasn't ready. You see, I was one of those that wasn't ready. You know, I kept trying it, kept going out, coming in, going back out, going in, coming back out. And that was my life all along for a long time, you know. And my lifestyle was like a blur, you know. If you abuse drugs and alcohol the way I did, your life would be a blur too. And that's what happened for me for a long time. There's a lot of parts of my life. And now I want to get to where the magic began for me. And what happened back in September 1905 was, at that time I was on parole. And my parole officer, and the reason I don't stay back, you know, just to back up a little bit, I don't really dwell on my past too much, is because, like I said, through the steps, I'm no longer a victim. And what happened to me back in back in September was, my parole officer had put me in a program. And I can't tell you the first 30 days of that program, you see, because I was gone. I was gone. The alcohol and the other stuff had took me there. I was gone. I can't even tell you those first 30 days. I was gone. And from that day, then he put me to another sober living place. And part of that program was for me to go to these meetings, AA. And I can't tell you, and to be honest, I didn't really want this thing. I didn't even know that I could stay sober. I didn't know. I just know that I didn't like the way I was living. I was sick and tired, just being sick and tired of the high cost of low living. That's all I knew. I was sick and tired of the high cost of low living. That's all I knew. But I didn't know how to live life, you see? And I started going to these meetings, and which is, I call my home group, LOLT, Life on Life's Terms, and I would sit in the back. You know, people would call it death row. I call it sitting wherever I want to sit. That's the way I call it. You know, that's how I called it. And for the first 2 years of my recovery, I went to 3 meetings a day, you see, because I didn't know how to live. But I didn't want to die either. And I'm not going to tell you that my sobriety started there. You know, I used to hear that word, clean and sober. And I always thought it meant the same thing, but it didn't. And what happened for me was, you know what? I knew I was powerless. Like that step one, I knew that I was powerless and that my life was unmanageable. Just telling you this little bit about me will tell you where the manageability of my life was. You see? And it was in the powerlessness, you know? And that was easy. That step one was easy for me at that time. Like I said, I was sick and tired of the high cost of low living. And that step two, coming to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Well, you know, I have a friend that talks about the burning bushes. I wasn't talking to burning bushes. I knew I was insane because of the lifestyle I lived and the things that I did, you know. And that was easy to do too, you know. And the third step, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. You know, when I first got clean, you couldn't talk to me about God. You know, I knew there was a God, but my mind was so twisted with this God thing, you see, because of the things that happened to me as a child. You couldn't talk to me about God because I would come at you like the exorcist. You know, I would. Because I wanted you to back off. I wanted you to back off, you see. And that's one of the beauty of this program, that I got to choose a power of my choice, a God of my understanding. Not your God, but my God, you see. And that's what made it easy. And to surrender. At that time, I had 5 months clean. Like I said, I had no sobriety. I had 5 months clean. And I can tell you when that truly, truly surrender happened in my life. And to this day, I do not, it's like so vivid in my mind. See, I had 5 months clean, no sobriety. And you know, I had the isms. And like this little girl that I'm talking about, my firstborn, became an addict, the disease. And like I said, when I had 5 months clean, I was in this sober living. And I always say this story because it's so, so, so dear to me. You know, it's that gift of desperation that I carry today. Back then, and I still carry that gift of desperation today. That little girl, she's a woman now. She had got arrested while I'm in this program. She had got arrested with some gang members. And I got the call that she was arrested with these gang members. And I'm in this program, and we're allowed to leave. I'm in the sober living program. My parole officer had put me in. And I go over there to where my daughter is because I'm worried about my grandkids, you see. I want to know who has my grandkids. You know, I couldn't even take care of myself, and I'm worrying about who's going to take care of my grandkids. So I go to this place where my daughter's at, and my daughter's sitting in the curb, and there's a cop there, and she tells the cop, "That's my mother. She'll tell you who I am." And like I said, I was clean. I had no sobriety. And I came from that prison mentality that I wasn't going to give you up no matter what. And that's my daughter right there. And she's looking me in the eye, you know, because she's giving a fake name. And when the cop says that, I go along with my daughter. You see, I have the ism. See, I'm clean. I have no sobriety. And I go along with it. And they're going to release my daughter to me, right? They're going to cite her out and whatnot. And then my other daughter shows up, and she doesn't know what's going on, my other daughter, right? So she calls my daughter by her real name and me. And after my daughter just gave a fake name, you know, I'm on parole. You know, I lied to a cop. They put the cuffs on me so fast, and they put them on my daughter. A bunch of us went to jail. And I don't know how many of you guys have been in a county jail in Bookie, you know, that Travis cement. And I remember it as clear as if it was yesterday. And I'm sitting on that slab of cement, and my daughter's all tweaked out. She's talking on the phone to whoever. And I'm sitting there, and, you know, excuse my French, but I say, like, what the F? You know, what the F? You know, what the heck? You see, because I've done a lot of dirty shit in my life. I mean, a lot of shit I'm not proud of. Because, you know, with the disease, it takes you to places you say you'll never be. You know, those yets that we say we'll never do. You know, those things that we say that we'll never do. You know, that list, it goes down. It goes down in that disease. And there was something in me. And like I said, I came from a very dysfunctional home. I don't know where this thing came from in me, in the pit of my stomach and my heart. It was like the ultimate sin. I did not want to be one of those mothers that went to the joint with her daughter. I don't care how dirty, how low I hit. That to me was the ultimate sin. I did not want to be one of those mothers. And I remember saying a prayer, and I'm not talking about that little red wagon prayer. You know that prayer we say, "Oh God, please let me get away with this one." I'm not talking about that prayer. I'm talking about that third step prayer where I make that decision. And you know what? Here, God, you take over. Let me move aside. And you know what? I can't tell you that lightning came into that booking room or not. I just know that a feeling came over me that day. And I cannot describe that feeling to this day, but I just knew that my life was not going to be the same from that day forward. And I'm not gonna, and they didn't release me, but I knew that a peaceful feeling came over me. And I knew that whatever happened to me, I was going to be okay. I didn't know if I was going to go back to the joint on a violation because I lied to the police officer and I was already in a program, or I was going to be let out. You see, but all along, my higher power, who I used to call God, had his hand on my shoulder because I was allowed to go back to that program. And for the remainder of that time that I was in that program, I had to keep my mouth shut because self-will is what got me there. Elena trying to do it her way is what got her in that county jail. And there's where, from that day forward, is where the miracle began to happen. I began to learn about this thing called sobriety in AA. I continued going to meetings. I got a sponsor. It didn't work out. I got another sponsor. It didn't work out. She's my best friend today. And you know, and that's what happens, and it's okay. You know, and I always suggest, go to meetings till you find that person you can dance with. Because you don't got to dance with everybody, but you're going to dance with somebody in AA. And that's what I've learned. And I continue going, and then I got this sponsor, the sponsor that I have today. And she began to take me through the steps, you see. And it wasn't easy, you know. And to do that fourth step, made a furtive and searching inventory of myself, that was hard. That fourth step, you know, for people to say it's an easy thing, it's not an easy thing if you're going to get honest. Because you got to put it all out there, the meat and potatoes. You got to be honest with yourself. And And in that inventory process, you know, I have to look at the people I was pissed off on, the resentment, and what part I played in, what it affected me. You know, and you know, and I have to learn to forgive, too. You see, I have to learn to forgive those people that hurted me as a child. You know, and the forgiveness kicked in because I had to tell myself what happened to them to make them be monsters to me. And you know what, and I was always, and you know, and today I could never talk about my mother. And today I talk about my mother. See, my mother had no fault in a lot of this stuff. She, you know, she wasn't well. She had a mental illness. And that was hard, you know. And I take it hard because when my mother passed away, it took them 3 days to find me because I was out there ripping and running in my disease. You see, and that was a very hard, you know, to go through, you know. But what it did for me, the fourth step, was give me a lot of freedom. It gave me a lot more peace. It set me free. You know, I had to write all those resentments. You know, all that anger. Because behind all that anger was a whole lot of hurt. A whole lot of hurt. You know? And I had to share that with someone. You know? And I shared it with my sponsor. And I shared it with someone that, you know what, that truly loved me, truly understand. You know? And I was able to put all that, not half-assed, you know, because as the reading says, half measures avail is nothing. I had to give it my all because I didn't want to die. Once again, I was sick and tired of that high cost of low living. See, that gift of desperation has been with me and continue to be with me through my steps. And then when it came to the character defects, wow, that was, you know, character defects, me? You know, cuss you out and, you know, make amends? No, you know, I had a whole lot of character. See, I was a very selfish person, jealous type of person. And all them seven deadly sins, I was part of it, you know. And do they go away by saying that seven-step prayer? Asking him to remove every single defect of character that stands in my way of my usefulness to you and my father? No. Sometimes they spring up. They're still there. You know? But I'm more aware today and I recognize them because of the steps. You know? And, you know, character defects are hard. They're really hard to live with and they're hard to look at. You know? The denial, you know? And, I have this friend in the program, and I had to learn, you know, I had to really work on that character defects of jealousy, you know, because he was like my best friend, and I was so jealous, and here in my recovery, and I can tell you one time where it really hurted me, you know, because we went to a meeting together, and this girl talked to him, and I left his ass there at the meeting. And what's funny was he didn't even know that I felt that way from him. You see, because I have the isms. You know, I have that sick mind. Yeah, that's character defects. Big time, you know. And he didn't even know what was wrong with me. That was a major, you know, jealousy. And I had to do inventory on that. And I had to check where that inventory came from, that jealousy, where that abandonment feelings came from, you know. And it goes back to the past, you know. And it's getting to the root, getting to the causes. The big book talks about that. The alcohol is only but a symptom. We have to get deep into the causes. And that's what, you know, what the character defects was about, too. And then making that list, you know, the amends list. That was hard, too. And to back up a little bit on that fourth step, the freedom that it gave me about the causes was at that time that I started back, when I started on my fourth step, I'm raising this little girl today. She's 8 years old. She turned 8 yesterday. No, on the 7th. When I got this little girl, my granddaughter, you know, I got her at the age of 4 years old. And this little girl was abused in every way, just like I was when I was a child. See, God has a way of revealing things to me for me to work on my steps. And when I got this little girl, she was abused. And I had about 4 years clean at that time. And it was really, really hard for me because, you see, that was a lot of pain in my life through the inventory on that little girl when I was doing my inventory. And the big book talks about sometimes we seek outside help. And I have to seek outside help. on that, you see, because I wanted revenge, you know, for what happened to her. And that little girl has been my teacher, just like you guys have been my teacher, you know. And that is, you know, I just have to put that in because she played a major role on my 4-step, because there's where a lot of my freedom. And, you know, God put her as an instrument in my life at that moment, at that time. And I still have that little girl today in my life. And just as I'm growing in my recovery, she's growing. She's healing, too. We're both healing. And when I had to make that amends list, you know, it wasn't easy because I have 4 daughters. And like I said, CPS never got involved in my life, but I gave my kids the worst form of child abuse. I gave them emotional abuse. And that wasn't easy to look at. It wasn't easy. I had to take a look at all that. And that's not a pretty picture to look at as a mother, as a woman, to what I put my kids through, to say that, yeah, I put the alcohol first before my kids. Yeah, I put the drugs first before my kids. That was me. And I own it today. You see, I can own that shit today. See, because if I don't own it, it'll keep me out there. See? And I had to make those amends. And I had to sit with each one of my daughters. And what I was told when I did my amends was I had to put me first on that list. I had to learn to forgive Elena. I had to put me first. And then I had to get each one of my daughters and sit with them and let them know. And it wasn't about, oh, it's okay, Mom, because it's not okay. It's not okay. See, I had to do that. I had to sit down with each of my kids, and I had to sit there and talk to them about what happened to them, because Mom was so busy ripping and running. You know, 2 of them had got molested. You know, what I didn't want happened to my kids. It was like a cycle repeating itself. And having to make amends. I'm not going to tell you when I came to the institutions, I went to every store I ripped off and told them I was sorry. I wasn't that crazy. Because remember, step 2, restore me to sanity. So I didn't go to them stores. I'll tell you that. That I did not do when I came to the institution. No. But I have a way of making amends back. You know, I give. You know, once a year, I volunteer at nonprofit organizations. There's a way of giving back. You know. And that's my style of giving back, you know. And that's how I deal with the institutions and the people I hurt. And it's still an amends is a lifeline process, lifelong. You know, God puts these people in front of my life when it's time for me to make those amends. Some of them are not completed. Some of them are yet to be done. And then the 10th step, you know, the inventory, you know, having to... I do a spot check inventory every night. You know, I reflect back on who I hurt, what could I have done better, did I harm that person, do I owe them an amends? And you know what the 10th step has done for me, and I was just talking to my friends on the way up here, it's giving me a conscience. You see, because to be honest, I didn't want to come here. I was going to call up Bill and say that it was foggy or something, and there ain't no damn fog out there. But you know what? I can't do that today. You know, I can't. I can't lie today. See, that's what the steps do for me today. I can't lie. I can't lie as good as I used to today. I can't. Because it's given me a conscience. It has allowed me to feel today. See, that's what this AA has done for me. It has allowed me to feel because I couldn't feel before. Like I said, I learned to disassociate. The 10th step has allowed me to feel, to reflect. Did I harm this person? Do I care? Yes, I do. Yes, I do care today. You know, that's one of the reasons I'm here. You know, I believe in that saying, you know, I am responsible when anyone, anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to always be there, and for that I am responsible. See, that kicks into my mind just like that, and that's what brings me here. See, and then service work, you know, helping others helps me get out of self, because I could get caught up in self, you know, carrying the message. You ain't got to die today. And you know, one of the most beautiful things, how many minutes do I have? Well, I'm not a long-winded person. On a one-on-one I am, but not on the speaker. You know, one of the most beautiful things that AA has done for me was that all my life I was looking for someone to love Elena, looking for love in all the wrong places, looking through it through the abuse. And what AA has done, because of AA and because of the steps and because of you people, I finally found someone to love Elena. I found Elena. Thank you.